This is an ABC podcast.
No, ia e Māori, tēnā koe and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Well, it's Monday morning. Hope you've had a great weekend. I'm Aggie Thibault and you're tuning into our show from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. There is a lot happening in the region with the US finally coming through with their promised funds for the Pacific in return for exclusive US military access to their territories. And who is Jason Palmer and what's his affiliation with American Samoa? And Fijian entertainer receives major tourism award, but some are not fans of his style. More on that later in the show. But once our show is done, you can find our stories by simply typing into your search engine Pacific Beat, with highlights via our Facebook and Instagram page at ABC Pacific. Let's get into the show. I'm Aggie Thibault and this is Pacific Beat. Maybe 5 months behind schedule, but US President Joe Biden's signature on a new law approving funding for the Compact of Free Association countries have been warmly welcomed in the Pacific. The $3.5 billion law provides much-needed funds to Palau, Marshall Islands and the Federated States of Micronesia in return for exclusive US military access to their territories. Now, the President of the Federated States of Micronesia, Wesley Semina, welcomed the extension of the compact.
The path to this day has been longer than expected and a challenging road that raised concerns about if and when the updated compact agreements would enter into force. This understandably may have stirred doubt and uncertainty. But in this, you can be certain. At the end of the day, the FSM and the US reached an agreement on an outcome that I am confident will benefit both our nations and contribute to greater peace and prosperity for our peoples and to greater security and stability for the Indo-Pacific region and the world.
And in a national address over the weekend, President Semina says the new compact will provide new benefits for people of the Federated States of Micronesia.
The FSM will receive mandatory appropriations of $140 million annually for sector grants for 20 years beginning in fiscal year 2024. This increased economic sector assistance is to be used in the same sectors as under the current amended compact: education, healthcare, private sector development, the environment, public sector capacity building, infrastructure, and enhanced reporting and accountability. These funds may also be used for other sectors as may be mutually decided by the FSM and the United States in the future. As we all know, the years since the signing of the compact have highlighted the threat that we and other small island nations face as a result of human-caused climate change. This reality is reflected through the agreement's additional mechanisms and expansion of funding that will allow us to access emergency assistance, adaptation funding, and to more effectively climate-proof our infrastructure. In addition, the United States will make a mandatory contribution of $250 million in fiscal year 2024 and again in fiscal year 2025, totaling $500 million for the Compact Trust Fund. This extra infusion will help the fund's long-term sustainability for the FSM. The two agreements that will govern the administration of funds, the Fiscal Procedures Agreement and the Compact Trust Fund Agreement, have also been updated. The changes made will provide the FSM greater autonomy and control of its use of compact funding.
And that is President of the Federated States of Micronesia, Wesley Semina. Now, Australia's opposition has announced its intention to champion nuclear power should it win government at the next elections, saying nuclear energy is the future of clean energy. But for Australia's closest neighbours, how would this fit into the Pacific's clean green image and anti-nuclear position? Dubravka Volodia takes a look.
The relationship with nuclear technology in the Pacific region is a difficult and oftentimes tragic one.
Now but 5 seconds to go, and...
Between 1946 and 1958, the United States detonated 24 nuclear bombs around Bikini Islands in the Marshall Islands.
Equal to a discharge of 60,000 depth charges, each weighing 600 pounds, strikes the gears of the
Alston Killen from the country's National Nuclear Commission says the effects are still being felt by his community.
We got relocated from our small islands for the good of mankind, to stop all the wars in the world. Of course, the results is we were forced to move out. We were relocated from it. We're not going back anytime soon. We're homeless for the good of mankind.
Mr. Killen says while weapons tests differ from energy generation, it's still the same nuclear fission technology.
Nuclear is nuclear. And maybe there are ideas that will be on the table to explain the safest way to go. But there's really nothing in the world that you can say that they are 100% safe.
Following a series of nuclear weapons tests, Pacific countries came together in 1985 to create a nuclear-free weapons zone through the Treaty of Rarotonga. A feature of the treaty is keeping the region free of pollution by radioactive waste and material. Paul Barker from the Papua New Guinean think tank, the National Research Institute, says understandably, nuclear technology is a sensitive issue in the region.
The Pacific has been a region where a lot of the nuclear testing over the generations has occurred in different atolls, including by the United States, by the French in Mururoa Atoll over the years. And so the Pacific Islands have taken a strong and concerted position over the years of seeking to retain the Pacific region as a nuclear-free zone.
There are many countries around the world that use nuclear technology without major problems. The world's last nuclear disaster happened at the Fukushima power plant about a decade ago. That disaster was caused after an earthquake and tsunami. Nuclear energy is also seen as an alternative to fossil fuels, which could help countries in their transition to net zero. But Drew Slatter, a Pacific climate warrior from the organization 350.org, says it's a concerning proposal.
Nuclear energy, it's a dangerous distraction from the need to scale up genuine, safe and just renewable energy. We have a long, painful history with the shortfalls of nuclear power. So this is extremely concerning, the proposals to install nuclear reactors in our backyard in Australia. Japan themselves will observe 13 years since the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster. When nuclear goes wrong, it goes very wrong.
Mr. Barker says it could take Australia years to establish nuclear power plants. And with climate change already affecting Pacific nations, he says it's an issue that could impact the whole region.
Of course, it would take Australia a very long time to actually install such power plants. They're incredibly capital intensive, so it's not going to make a lot of difference in terms of cleaning up energy and emissions from coal-fired power stations for a long time if the aim was to replace coal with nuclear.
He says a quicker option could be more investment in green energy.
And that's Paul Barker from the Institute of National Affairs ending that report from Dubravka Volodya. Well, I said at the beginning of the show, who is Jason Palmer? Well, that's a question many Americans and media were asking themselves following the results of primary voting in 16 states and one territory.
Well, Joe Biden swept Super Tuesday, almost. American Samoa's six delegates will actually go to another candidate. And he's someone that I guarantee you most Americans have not heard of before tonight. His name is Jason Palmer. You see him right there on the screen. Harry, how did Jason Palmer pull off this major upset or minor upset, however you want to look at it?
And in denying US President Joe Biden a clean sweep in the 16 states and one territory, taking part in the Democratic primaries, Jason Palmer has made a name for himself. But one person who wasn't surprised by the results was the chair of the American Samoa Democratic Party, Patrick Tia Reid.
A lot of people are very surprised. We've been the subject of a lot of memes across the country here in the States. But I personally am not surprised here on the ground. They did have an active presence. They hired local organizers, so they were able to get, speak to people about Palmer's vision and his ideas for the country. And, you know, ultimately, at the end of the day, it's a numbers game, right? You register and you get folks to turn out and support, and that's how you win caucuses and primaries.
I think it was just 91 people in the caucus. Is that a sort of typical amount for?
No, it's actually a much lower turnout. Our last caucus in 2020 was actually one of our biggest turnouts, and it we had a lot of candidates on our ballot. I want to say maybe four or five candidates on the ballot, several of which were actively organizing. So they were critical in kind of driving the registration and our turnout in the last caucus. This election season, I would say Palmer was the only one that was actively organizing. And, you know, turnout was just lower than normal. We did spend money on, investing in promo and marketing. Unfortunately, we did have a lower turnout, but it is what it is.
And what's a typical turnout?
The last one we had 300 to 400 folks turn out and register. So yeah, this is a much smaller, even with increased advertising for the event. I don't know why, but that's definitely something that we'll need to work on and moving forward. Just continuing to educate. You know, it's still very much an education. I feel issue education and awareness issue. One, that the event's happening. Two, why is it important for me to come out and, you know, participate in these caucuses, especially if I can't vote for president, right?
How do you sell that to someone? You know, why participate when they can't, you know, have that final say in the election?
I mean, we have to make do with what we do have, what we can participate in, right? Rather than just not participating and completely disengaging. The nomination process is an important process in getting to the general elections and ultimately who gets to occupy the White House and lead our country for the next 4 years. So my message is that we should be exercising our civic duties. These are important processes. Every election is important. We should have a say, and that's what democracy looks like, in democracy in action, right? Participating where we can and how we can to ultimately shape our elections and the leadership that we want to see.
And, I mean, this is not the first time that American Samoa has sort of gone against the grain of the rest of the state.
I do know that in 2020, Bloomberg was also the cause for a lot of surprise. And, again, I wasn't surprised. I was actually a Bloomberg organizer. I was recruited by the Bloomberg campaign to help. And I think the message for me and for the party and for, you know, the country who might be surprised is that organizing is important. It's a critical part of democracy. It's about speaking to the everyday folks. It's about selling your vision. It's about talking about the issues that matter to them and, ultimately getting them out to come and support your vision or whatever your platform is and what you believe are important issues for our country and for the people that you're seeking their vote.
Yeah. And what are the issues for locals? I mean, is it marginally different to the rest of the United States?
In my opinion, I wouldn't say so. I would say they're facing the same everyday issues that Americans around the country are facing: access to quality and affordable healthcare. The threat of climate change might be a little bit more real and visible here as territories. You know, we face natural disasters being coastal communities, so we see the rising sea levels. We deal with hurricanes. We deal with tsunamis. Not too long ago, we had a disastrous tsunami. So these things are very real and present in folks' minds, and it's something that the issues Americans face are similar across the board, as well as jobs, good paying jobs to be able to support their families.
What does it mean to have, American Samoa in the headlines, having, people around the world hearing about this place, hearing about, having that front of mind, even if it is for, one run of the news cycle? What is the value of having that?
I mean, I think it's opportunities like these, right, to better educate folks who may not have heard about American Samoa. A lot of Americans don't even know about American Samoa. So it's an opportunity for me, at least, to be able to educate folks. Now, as a chairman, it's an opportunity for me to educate folks about the needs of our party and how we can better grow as a party, and the importance of investing in of presidential campaigns and investing in our territories and making for a stronger democracy. So, I mean, although there were some memes behind of our attention, I think, you know, any attention is good attention. And I use that as an opportunity to better educate and to let people know about American Samoans and the issues that matter to us.
And that's Chair of the American Samoa Democratic Party, Patrick Tia-Reed, speaking there to ABC's Lachlan Bennett. And Jason Palmer will be looking to repeat his success in American Samoa when the primaries head to the Pacific Territory of Guam in June. Stay tuned, because up next we've got News Wrap with producer Mackenzie Smith.
Hi, I'm Seyuli Salama Sinovan-Raiki, and I invite you to come with me to explore how our Pacific cultures have evolved with the changing times in a new show, Culture Compass. You'll meet people who are passionate about keeping traditions alive, passing them down to the next generation while adapting old ways to the present. Culture Compass, Tuesdays at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Yes, as always, we head around the region just to get the latest with NewsRap, and that's brought to you by producer Mackenzie Smith. With that, I say good morning, Mackenzie.
Morning, Angie.
Yeah, thank you for joining me this morning. We head to Samoa because it looks like citizens there living overseas will be able to vote in the next election.
We do, yeah. RNZ reports that Samoa's parliament on Friday passed an amendment to the Electoral Act, which gives Samoans overseas the chance to vote for the first time for many of them, including an estimated 107,000 in New Zealand. Now, to qualify as an overseas voter, you have to be a Samoan citizen aged 21 years or older who has resided in Samoa at some point. Applicants must also undertake a biometric test in Samoa to qualify. In Parliament on Friday, opposition MPs claimed the changes would give too much power to outsiders, a claim that the government denies.
That's interesting, because I feel like plenty of people in the diaspora would be very much looking forward to being part of that. But we'll keep our eyes and ears on that story. Fiji's former elections supervisor is facing corruption charges. Gosh, what is the case against him?
Yeah, according to Fiji Village, Mohamed Sanim was on Friday charged with obtaining a corrupt benefit for himself while he was the election supervisor under the previous Bainimarama government. So that charge relates to $50,000 he allegedly received in tax relief from a government official. It's further alleged that the sum would influence Sanim in his duties as election supervisor. Sanim is in police custody and is expected to appear in court in Suva today.
Look, we stay in Fiji. Mackenzie, the commander of the armed forces, has vowed to redeem the institution. What has he actually said?
Well, Fiji Village reports Major General Jone Koloniwai saying Fiji's armed forces need to redeem itself by acknowledging past wrongs and seeking reconciliation from those that have been affected. Koloniwai reportedly asked RFMF members in a speech to reach out to those they had personally wronged and to set things right. His comments come as the Australian Defence Force is looking into its hiring process for Ben Naliva, who is currently serving as Deputy Commander of the 7th Brigade, after allegations emerged that Naliva was involved in torturing government opponents in Fiji following the 2006 coup.
Well, Mackenzie, thank you very much for bringing our news wrap this morning. Appreciate it.
No worries, Aggie.
That, of course, is Mackenzie Smith there with our news wrap here on Pacific Beat.
Want to catch up or listen again to your favourite ABC Radio Australia programs anytime, anywhere? From Pacific Beat to Stories from the Pacific, Nisian Footy to Culture Compass. You can listen to your top shows on your favourite podcast app on the go and for free. Just search for your favourite ABC Radio Australia program in your podcast app and press play. ABC Radio Australia, bringing you more ways to listen.
Absolutely. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie DuBois. Please make sure that you do get some time to check out all the shows that we have here on ABC Pacific. We head to Vanuatu, where a group of young people from one of its remote islands is preserving their local language and nature at the same time. Learn to Serve Pentecost is a youth-led organisation formed late last year on the island of Pentecost. While their focus was originally environmental conservation, they quickly realised their custom language was under threat as well. That sparked the idea to record and learn the traditional names of native trees and the stories behind them. Marion Farr spoke with project coordinator Joanna Wally.
So our mother tongue in South Pentecost is called Sa language. We noticed that a lot of the young people, I'm not sure, not only the young people, but I'm pretty sure a lot of people in South Pentecost do not know the native traditional names of our native trees in our language. So we decided to come up with this project to actually start somewhere to get two or three old people in our communities to actually walk around with us, to actually go in like the bush, to go tracking in the bush and to just learn the names of the native trees.
From a conservation perspective, why is like learning the names, the traditional names of these plants and trees so important?
So from a conservation perspective, we also understand that we're slowly losing like most of our resources, like our natural resources, like I've mentioned earlier, due to like the Category 5 cyclone. And also we have like also developments happening in like our communities. And also people are also clearing the bushes for food, for crops, and also for cash crops. So we wanted to do this activity to also conserve like not only the names of the trees, but also we also understand how the trees are being used, like from the past, from our grandparents, from our great-grandparents to up to now. Yeah.
Joanna, could you tell us the traditional name of one of the trees in your area and the story behind it? Maybe if there's like a particular tree that has significance in Pentecost, in South Pentecost?
Yeah, sure. So one of the trees that we actually learned last Saturday, it's called Amtarpuis in our native language. It's normally one of the trees that when people walk up to the garden or went up to the forest, it just grows everywhere. But when we went up to do the activity last Saturday, we actually learned that the tree has a great significance to like our grandparents from our past generations, because like the tree was used to, you know, like Pentecost is a place where we have a lot of snakes. Yeah, most of the time when people went up to the garden, there'll be snake like sleeping just across the footpath or like the roads up to the garden, or on top of the tree on the branches. So the elder people, they use the tree Amtarpuis for like to just point at the snake, and then the snake just leave the road, or they say it's used to scare the snake away or something like that. Yeah.
Can you tell us, Joanna, who's involved in this work and in this project?
The people involved in like the activity that day was mainly the youth that is affiliated or that is working with the Learn to Serve Pentecost. We actually started the organization last year on like the 14th of September, where we get like two young people each from like each communities in South Pentecost to represent the community in like this youth organization.
And is this an ongoing project? Have you got more sort of trips planned or more activities planned?
Yeah, sure. So we have like big plans ahead for this year. Since we started last year, we've been concentrating on like rehabilitation activities. So we actually plan like Notongtong, sorry, mangroves sorry, not Tong Tong, is in Bishlama. So we plant like mangroves along like the few of the coastal areas in South Pentecost where we see a lot of activities of sea level rise. For this year, we have a lot of activities that is lined up. And we want to thank like those people, especially those NGOs that has been supporting us by giving us small grants for us to carry out these activities.
And that's Learn to Serve Pentecost Project Coordinator Joanna Uwari speaking with Marion Farr. Now, for tourists visiting Fiji's numerous resorts, entertainment often comes in the form of cultural dancing. One dancer, Navi Fong, does things a little differently, and he recently received a major tourism award, which is the first entertainer to do so. But as our reporter in Fiji, Lede Mavono, discovered, some Fijians are not a fan of his style.
Navi Fong has been dancing since he was 17 years old. Now 30, he has been around the world representing Fiji's culture in the form of dance. And earlier this month was one of his proudest moments.
And then when I found out that, I had been awarded that, the Rising Star Award, it was very, I was very shocked at first and then just feeling quite very grateful.
Navi is the creative director at the Vo Dance Company, overseeing 40 dancers who entertain guests at Fiji's resorts. They also travel the world, going as far as Uzbekistan to promote Fiji abroad. It is part of the Fiji travel experience, yet he is the first manager from the entertainment industry to receive a Fiji Excellence in Tourism Award, a fact that he is proud of.
And it was just lovely to feel like many decades of work, we were finally seeing a shift in the perspective at a national level of what the value of creative arts is within something like tourism, the value of creative arts to the economy, creative and cultural industries, yeah? Finally, we're starting to understand how we're so, as artists, we're very intricately and purposefully like interwoven into the fabric of what it means to be of service to people who come to Fiji seeking out a memorable experience with their families or with each other.
Navi operates from a stage performance facility just outside Ndenerau Island, Fiji's main tourist hub. Trained and proficient in several genres of dance, Navi's specialty is a style he refers to as fusion. While it has grown from strength to strength, the company established by Sachiko Soro is not welcomed by everyone. It is often criticized for not portraying authentic indigenous Fijian culture, a trait Navi defends.
Something that we have been able to pride ourselves on for a long time as well. We think of things from the audience perspective always. And that is why we tend to be able to draw in a good audience is because when we are creating, we are thinking about what the audience needs from this performance. Like, what is the why? Why are they going to come and attend this? What is the deep, fundamental impetus for them having come to watch a show? Was it to be entertained? How can we entertain them? Why do they need to be entertained? Those are sort of the things we ask ourselves as opposed to what would I like to say? I feel that at one point in our evolution as a company, that was our point of view. We wanted to create things that were true to us and us and us and us. After a couple of years, we decided to just shift that outwards and think about what can we offer people that they may need for themselves.
Navi believes that while technical ability is important, there is a unique spirit in the way Fijians and other Pacific Islanders dance that will continue to draw crowds.
100%, in my very humble opinion, but my very strong opinion, I really feel that the Fijian performing arts and Fijian culture has an unmistakable and very vehement sort of spirit about it. You know, there is a magic in the way Fijian performers are able to embody intention on, whether that be on stage or elsewhere. There is a difference in the way the presence and what we call mana, you know, here in the Pacific. It is recognizable throughout the world wherever you go, and it is always something that is commented on.
And that's dancer Navi Fong ending that report from Lede Mavono. Now turning to sports news. It's been an exciting weekend in Pacific sports, especially in rugby with Fiji, parting ways with its Rugby Sevens coach, just 4 months though, out from the Olympic Games. While in Super Rugby, the Fijian Drua recorded their first win in the new season of the Super Rugby Pacific competition, and it was done in style. So to take us through these key events, we're joined by the administrator of the Fiji Rugby Facebook group and sports writer Tia Roko. With that I say good morning, Tia.
Pacific greetings and good morning from Alice Springs, Aggie. Thanks
Beautiful.
For having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much, Tia, for joining us. Gosh, as we get straight into it, can you tell us how it actually unfolded? What was the final straw for Fiji Rugby to really part ways with Sevens coach Ben Gollings?
Well, when it comes to Fiji Rugby, it has been an interesting week in the lead up to the announcement of the new Sevens coach, Aggie. And to give it some context, Fiji is looking to defend their gold medal title in Paris. So the turn of events since the beginning of the year all leads to the Olympic Games in Paris come end of July. So 4 months out, to be clear. Now, Aggie, but if we backtrack a little bit further, for a bit of context for our listeners, Fiji Rugby has been in the hot seat since their suspension to the World Rugby Council early last year, and they were given until January this year to get the organisation in order in terms of compliance and governance in an institution that has been marred historically with financial scandal and corruption. So on Friday, a press conference was held in Suva, and it was announced that the national coach Ben Gollings was finally let go after 19 tournament losses. And Peter Maisie, the Fiji Rugby interim chair, said that Gollings had received his first verbal warning, rather, in November, his second in the South after the South Africa Sevens tournament, and his third was given after the Perth Sevens in Australia, and Gollings was finally given a warning letter after the Vancouver Sevens. So it's also believed that the Fiji Prime Minister's office, Aggie, had put pressure on the interim leadership of Fiji Rugby to call for a meeting to address all Sevens issues once the team arrived back on the ground from the LA Sevens. And sources say that the interim leadership of Fiji Rugby were told that if they were not going to have a meeting, that the government was going to intervene and hold a meeting. So as a side note, the interim committee, Aggie, are government appointees themselves. It's rather bizarre how this has come to light, which has ignited a fire from Fiji Rugby supporters calling for the sacking of Peter Maisie and the interim board. And as far as this meeting on Friday, sources have told me that it was a very tense meeting with Sevens coaches and management, and people have gone head to head asking for explanations. There was also talk of interferences during the recent LA Sevens from the HP women's manager, Alana Thomas, which has caused quite a bit of tension from within and addressed openly during this meeting. And Thomas, since her arrival to Fiji Rugby, has also been rather interesting and not discussed openly, but I'm told that there is growing local tension, Aggie.
Goodness, Tia, you know, Fiji has yet to win like a Sevens tournament under Gollings, and was a sacking inevitable? And do you actually agree with, like, the FRU's decision?
Maybe, perhaps it was a bit too late in the piece. So, you know, the performance of the team, as you can imagine, for Fiji, as Jerry Tuai has also stated, Fiji expects only gold when it comes to the Olympics. And when it is this time of the year, there's definitely a lot of worry given their current losses. And, you know, we now know that Gollings' replacement will be Osea Kolonisau, who is the first captain who won gold for Fiji in 2016. And he is protege and close friend to former winning coach Ben Ryan. So throughout Fiji, this news was received with sentimental joy, given the connection, and somewhat relief, as you can imagine, Aggie. So it was also announced later on Friday that Jerry Tuai will be back on board with the National Sevens team. And mind you, there has been previous contentious issues around this under Gollings' leadership. And there's also now talk of a director of a Sevens program in Fiji, with names being touted like Wesele Serevi, Sevens maestro, or the king of Sevens, he's called.
Wow. Look, now that we do know about Ben Golling's replacement, again, Osea Golinasau, you think he's the man for the job? Because, I mean, we're sitting at about 4 months out to the Olympics. You think he can pull together this current squad to win gold at the Olympics?
Yes, most definitely. I think he has a chance. He's got great rapport with the Sevens leadership in Fiji. With players, he has a strong level of respect. And, you know, as always, I will point us back to the leadership. You know, there's a strong call by the people of Fiji or Fijians around the world for the government to remove the current interim leadership. And these people are there to temporarily fix governance and compliance issues. And, you know, they're not rugby experts. So, you know, Kolinisau is much well-favoured, and we're looking forward to what's going to happen in the next few weeks.
Absolutely. Tia, we really appreciate your time this morning. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Aggie.
No worries. That, of course, is Fiji Rugby Facebook group and sports writer Tia Roko joining us here this morning on Pacific Beat. Podcasting has grown in popularity across the world, and in the region, more and more creators are taking up as a medium for storytelling and to share ideas. A new Pacific series has been launched at the Centre for Pacific Island Study at the University of Hawaii. Pacific Currents is hosted by Dr. Tarsisius Tara Kabuntaulaka and Kenji Kataldo, with the aim of celebrating life in Oceania and amplifying the voices of artists and scholars from the region. One Talk reporter Sam Siki caught up with series co-host Kenji Kataldo to find out more about the project.
The Oceania Currents is a new bi-weekly podcast from the Center for Pacific Island Studies at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. And our goal is to weave together stories and voices and conversations from across Oceania, bringing together storytellers, artists, scholars, filmmakers, and talk about stories and issues of concern to Oceania.
So what is the aim of the podcast?
Yeah, the aim is to provide a platform for storytellers, for people, for communities of Oceania and other people who call Oceania home, to discuss issues, you know, like stories, storytelling, environment, geopolitics, a variety of issues, but really weaving these in a kind of storytelling approach that brings together voices and uplifts the voices of Oceania.
Okay, and what would you say is unique about the podcast? You know, why people would want to listen to it and what would they learn from it?
I think one of the unique features of the podcast is its ability to draw on this really broad and deep network that the Center for Pacific Island Studies has from its over 70 years of existence. This is some of the leading and emerging, you know, filmmakers, scholars, artists, from across the region who have passed through the center at some point or another or invited to come talk. So it's really amazing, deep roster of people and storytellers who are coming together and sharing stories in this space.
Okay. And your pool of talents in your network, they're all from the center?
So in terms of the team behind the podcast, it includes our superstar host, Dr. Tarsisius Kabuntaulaka, who I co-host with. And then we also had another CPIS student, John Taukeve, who wrote and composed the music, and another student in our broader CPIS community who designed the logo. So we really had a rich team here at the center. And in terms of our roster of guests, that includes both people who in the past have been affiliated with the center, as well as other people who just have relationships, you know, from decades of work in these fields across Oceania.
And they are from across the Pacific, of course.
Yes, they're from across the Pacific. So in our upcoming episodes, we have people from Rotuma, from the Marquesas, from Tahiti, trying to think of some of the others, from Banaba, guests who are calling in from Australia, as well as other places. So we launched the podcast last week. Our first episode went out last Tuesday, and we'll now be rolling with new episodes every other Tuesday.
So Kenji, is there anything else you might like to add about your podcast?
I think one thing I would like to say, you know, I think a podcast is a really exciting tool for a place like the Center for Pacific Island Studies to use as a kind of gathering space and as a medium where voices from across the region can speak across the region and can cross great geographical distances and connect with people in home communities all across the region as well as in diaspora. The Oceania Currents podcast can be listened to on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and all of the major podcast platforms.
And that's Kenji Kataro, co-host of Pacific Currents. It's a new podcast out from the University of Hawaii.
Join me, Melissa Makin, for Nisha Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday on ABC Radio Australia. I'll bring you the stories of the week from across the Pacific and talk health and religion with experts in their field and individuals making a difference. Nisha Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday from 4 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Time to take a look back at one of our main stories today. Plans by Australia's opposition to champion nuclear power should it win government at the next elections has sparked alarm in the Pacific, as Drew Slatter, a Pacific climate warrior, explains.
We have a long, painful history with the shortfalls of nuclear power, so this is extremely concerning, the proposals to install nuclear reactors in our backyard in Australia.
You can find those top stories online. Simply type Pacific Beat and Radio Australia in your search engine. We'll be back this afternoon at 5 p.m, but you can check back in tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. PNG time. Stay tuned, because ABC Radio Australia has your news next. And coming up after that, it is The Boys, Nisha Daily, Jacob McGuire and Michael Chow. Until next time, I'm Agatha Bowe, and you have been tuning into Pacific Beat.